I'm Faith Middleton. This show is about the richness of life. We're going to talk about humor. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. Here are some questions that we're going to get answers to. Have computers become good at humor? Why are some people so good at being funny while others aren't? And what about nature? Why are we designed to make jokes and to laugh? Scott Weems is our guest. He has a PhD in cognitive neuroscience from UCLA. He likes funny. And so he's been clever enough to put it all together. His book, Ha, looks at the science of when we laugh and why. We're going to talk about what happens in the brain. I want to know why some people, and they make me nervous, have no sense of irony or humor while others do. Comedians know what buttons to push to get us to laugh. So if it's a formula, what is it? And can you train your brain to be better at it? Laughter is, in fact, it turns out, good for us. That's not a myth. So how do we do it more? Scott Weems, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Here was a surprise from your book. There have been so many studies on laughter. I wasn't aware of that.
It is amazing, isn't it? How there have been. People have been looking at laughter for, 2,000, 3,000 years. I'm not sure if we've understood it. It's only maybe been in the past 10 years or so that we're kind of understanding why people laugh. That's kind of surprising to me, too. You would have think we would have figured it out by now.
Well, the figuring out is one thing, but I'm just enchanted by the fact that all these people, for all this time, have been making this, a so-called serious field of inquiry. And smart, too, because why do we have this wonderful capacity?
Yeah, I think laughter is very important. I try and separate a little bit the phenomenon of laughter with humor in general. Humor is even more vague than laughter. We laugh at all sorts of things, but what do we find funny? That's a problem that's plagued us for, since there have been humans on the earth, I think. And to me, it all comes down to a process. I don't think there is a formula for humor or laughter. And I think it's because it's really a process that we go through in our brains when we're confronted by things we don't immediately understand. And fortunately, that's often. We're often confused or overwhelmed. And I think that's why we laugh at a lot more than just jokes. We laugh at funerals and awkward situations and when meeting people for the first time. It's the most common emotional response we have.
Well, I think this is so smart of you to separate humor from laughing. And we're going to get to that distinction in just a second. But you described one scene, as I remember. I loved your book, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
One scene where somebody has to pick up something. I think it's increasingly heavy, and or at least it seems that way. And in the end, it turns out not to be so. And the person is surprised by that. And the first instinct is to laugh. And so you say that's an example of what?
Well, it's really an example of how we set up expectations. I love that study because there was nothing humorous about it, at least on the surface. That what the experimenters did is they had people come in and just pick up weights. They weighed a few pounds. They weren't that heavy, just little weights here and there. And they had them rate, would you call this heavy or would you call this light? And they did that for a lot of times. And then came the last one. This was the actual one they cared about. And this one was ridiculously light. So light that it made the others, even though they weren't particularly heavy, seem just incomparable. So they picked up that last one, and they're just shocked because they expect it to be kind of like the other ones they've picked up. And so they do like we so often do when we're surprised by something, is the subjects laughed. And so they laughed because they picked up a light object, about the weight of a piece of paper or something, which isn't funny by itself, but it's funny because they had an expectation. They went to that thinking that they were going to get something, and they got something else, which, although, this was an experimental context, that's not that different than, being confronted with a Groucho Marx joke or something like that, you're suddenly turned, and we like that. Our brains enjoy that surprise.
Yeah, so surprise turns out to be a key element, right? I'm trying to find as fast as I can, and you might know it off the top of your head, that remark, that line from Stephen Colbert. Here it is.
Oh, yeah.
He says, you said this is a perfect example of using surprise. His remark was, if I am reading this graph correctly, I'd be very surprised. So
yeah.
We think he's going to make a comment about the graph, and he does this thing he always does, which is to trick you in his language.
Yeah, there's actually a technical term for it, which you don't need to know, fortunately, to enjoy it. But it's called paraprosdokia, which means you, in the course of like a sentence, you start thinking one thing and then you go the other way. Which, I mean, that line, that Colbert line, is genius, and it's almost a perfect mirror of the Groucho Marx line. Yesterday, I shot an elephant in my pajamas. How it got in my pajamas, I'll never know.
Right. Bada boom.
Yeah, bada boom. Yeah. So who's wearing the pajamas depends on how far in that line you are. Just like with Colbert, what he's saying really about that graph depends on how far in that line you are. You're kind of surprised in the end.
So your idea is that the brain is wildly complex, the human brain. And as you write, if the brain were a government, it wouldn't be a dictatorship, a monarchy, or even a democracy. It would be anarchy. So the point being amazingly complex. I like this. Parts are connected to other parts, which are then connected to others, but nowhere in the system is there some final part deciding what we say or do. Instead, our brains act by letting ideas compete and argue for attention. This sometimes leads to conflict when we try to hold two or more inconsistent ideas at once. And when that happens, our brains know of only one thing to do. That's when we laugh.
Mm-hmm.
So it's conflict.
It is. And conflict isn't bad. It's how we deal with most of what we experience during the course of our day. Very, very seldom are we confronted with some experience or some problem that is straightforward, that we can tackle linearly. It's a shame. We so often think of the brain like a computer, which is relatively straightforward, although there's a lot of very complex machinery there. But there's input, there's output, there's a special area for memory and a special central processor which makes the decisions. And our brains don't work that way. This is kind of like it's anti-reductionism. So you're not trying to simplify the brain down to a specific formula or a specific process. Really, if you're likening it to a government, it's anarchy in there. And the whole brain is active all the time. So I think we'd be better off if we didn't simplify the way the brain deals with things. I think if we recognize this massive complexity, we'd get how humor is so closely linked with things like intelligence. It's amazing what we can do.
But I wonder if the ability to recognize this kind of complexity has to do with our wiring. I know that there's a set of people who see things in a very black and white fashion. It's this or it's this. And then these other people who totally get the shades of gray about everything. And that has always seemed like wiring to me. Is that right or not right?
It is, actually. And, you know, I never know how technical I really want to get into it. And I try and keep it just so, you know, you don't need to be a scientist to understand. But there is one part of the brain that's worth recognizing, and it's called the anterior cingulate. It's just below the surface, and it's basically our conflict detector. So we do have a part of the brain that gets very active when we're trying to hold multiple ideas at once. And the fascinating thing is, this area is very important for humor, but it's important for a whole lot more. And you see political differences, you see religious differences, mm-hmm. in how the anterior cingulate kind of jumps and gets involved, depending on what our beliefs are. So I'm of personal belief that the anterior cingulate access is good. You know, you want to be able to look for those shades of gray, as you say. That's how you notice the subtleties of life.
Do you think that if that cingulate region is really strong, you tend to go toward a particular political party?
Yeah, studies have shown that people with large anterior cingulates tend to be more liberal in their political persuasion.
So that's the shades of gray people.
Those are kind of shades of gray people. Now, this is interesting because there's another region that's larger for people who are conservative-minded, and that's the amygdala. And this is another brain region. It's a different area, but it's basically an emotional center. It deals with all kinds of emotions, but fear is one of them. And so it would be way oversimplifying to say that conservative people are afraid or, you know, they have stronger fear responses. But it just maybe shows how the two different sides look at problems differently. One side might think more emotionally about a problem, and another side might think about, shades of gray kind of thing.
Wow. I think, Scott, you've just explained a lot of political commercials that I see. Coming from Republican candidates, there is an element of maybe this isn't fair. There's an element, I would think, of fear. And, you know, advertisers use this all the time. And it's a technique that's been used constantly. And I think it's very effective.
It is. And, you know, whether fair or not fair, it's so hard to tell whenever you're simplifying like this. But you can't argue with the facts that you do see these differences. And so it actually is a great tool to have in your back pocket is, like you say, you're watching political ads. And sometimes you can have a political discussion with a friend, and it feels like you're speaking completely different languages. And I think that's what happens a lot of the time. One person might be speaking emotionally, another might be speaking in terms of shades of gray, and maybe that's why it seems like neither is able to convince the other what they believe is because it's just a different way of looking at life.
But the way that wiring goes affects how we are funny, appreciate humor, appreciate irony. So I get to this section in your book where you say that laughter is the most shared emotion that we have. So is that, would you say, more than love?
You know, that's hard to tell because how do you measure love?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's tough enough to measure laughter, and I love the way people do it. Generally, scientists just go out and eavesdrop on people, and they count the number of times they laugh.
Okay.
I don't know how you could go out and measure people for love.
So this
I would
is a
hope that
fact.
Love is more common, but I think they're both good things.
Okay, so it's really up there, we're going to say, that a lot of people share laughs.
Yeah.
Then you get to this section where you talk about these things that have happened around the globe, and honestly, my jaw was hanging open as I was reading this. I was sitting in the doctor's office, and I thought, I wrote on the page, what? So there was this Kagera region of Tanzania,
mm-hmm.
right? So this is along the western shores of Lake Victoria.
Yeah.
So what? Can you describe what happened in this place?
Yeah, it's the strangest epidemic in history, and it amazes me that we don't know about it so much. I mean, a lot of people haven't heard of it. It was in, as you said, it was called Tanganyika, I'm sorry, but today we know it as Tanzania. And basically, it started with three young girls in a missionary boarding school. They just started laughing. Which by itself is not, you know, not shocking at all. But then their friends started laughing, and this laughter spread throughout the whole school, so much so that they had to shut the school down, that there were, you know, pretty soon hundreds of girls just started laughing. They couldn't stop it. And apparently shutting down the school was a bad thing to do, because that meant that all the girls went home to their villages, and they went home laughing. And so that laughter sickness spread and eventually consumed over 1,000 people. Pretty much much of that region, like the whole country, was just overcome with laughter. You know, hundreds and hundreds of people.
Doesn't this sound like an urban legend?
Only it does.
A suburban legend.
And so you wonder, like, is this true? And yeah, no, there's accounts of anthropologists who followed up and know that it really happened.
Well, what in the world was going on?
Yeah, so this is the tough thing. It finally died out about a year and a half later.
A year and a half?
Yeah, a year and a half. Now, like, one person wouldn't laugh straight for a year and a half. You know, they'd laugh, and then they might stop a few hours or days later, and then another person would pass it on, and they'd laugh again. But I think you have to look at the situation at the time. The country was undergoing massive social change. Not only had they just gained independence, so the country was now an independent country, so basically the children changed from being European to actual true local Africans, then they had just desegregated the schools. Add to this that they were all basically entering puberty, so they were going through one of the biggest changes you can go through at the time. And there were churches that had just started entering the area and started proselytizing, so they were kind of switching from a tribal to what we know more as a Protestant or Catholic religious base. And so it's hard to pin down what the girls were basically in a state of transition where they didn't know who they were anymore. Every aspect of their life that they thought they knew was instantly gone.
Was it contagious for the? I mean, grown-ups start laughing in this this episode, so
yeah.
It can't have to just do with these girls in puberty.
Well, that's the fascinating thing is, take for example that first laughter outbreak in that school. There were three teachers, and they didn't get it. It was just the girls. Now, this isn't to say that there were no adults that laughed. I mean, I'm sure that there were some, and it's hard to measure. You know, like how do you really measure and account for this full thing? But it was primarily the young girls.
Was it hysteria?
Yeah, I mean, this is how we kind of write it off as hysteria. But you have cases of hysteria that don't involve laughter. So you kind of have to ask, what's special about this that laughter wound up being the behavior versus, for example, I think it was 16th century Spain, mm-hmm. when a similar outbreak occurred, except for there all the people started making farm animal noises for, you know, months at a time or whatever. You get incidents of mass hysteria sometimes happen, but this was unusual because it was laughter, I think.
Yeah, so fascinating. So I want to talk with you about, you describe something that happened to your wife in the movie theater, and I could identify so much because it certainly has happened to me. It's happened to other people at the communion rail, at funerals. You're just laughing in all the wrong places. So stick with us. Scott Weems, author of Ha, The Science of When We Laugh and Why. We'll be right back. You can find what we talk about on the show online anytime at WNPR.org. In other words, you can find out much more about this book that's the focus of our conversation. It's Scott Weems' book, Ha. And it's the science of when we laugh and why. Also at our website, you'll find lots of delicious things to eat and drink. But we have a link up there right now. To a university that has a computer, and if you sign in and you give that computer some words, some ideas, that computer will spit out a joke. And so it's kind of interesting to see how this computer changes over time and what the computer thinks. We're going to get into that, whether computers have gotten funnier over time. So, Scott, let's get to laughing in the wrong places. Your wife is at a screening of Titanic, and she starts laughing at a certain point. I remember seeing Madonna playing Evita Perón and was crying. I was laughing so hard. I mean, just falling out of my chair, and there wasn't a single other person in the theater. They were just rapt. They just couldn't understand. I couldn't believe them, and I don't think they could believe me. I thought it was the hokiest, most ridiculous thing, and it hilarious that people had gone to all this expense. So what's going on here? How does this happen? Why do we laugh in the wrong places?
Yeah, and I think we all have done that. I mean, I wouldn't feel bad because I bet there's every single one of us has had a moment like that. Sadly, my wife just happens to be married to the wrong person who decided to share it. But yeah, we laugh at a lot more than just jokes. And in the book, I bring this up right after the outbreak, the Tanganyika outbreak we just talked about, because I think that they share a lot in common. That what happened was my wife and I were watching Titanic, and near the end, when Leonardo DiCaprio is drowning, that's a very emotional scene. We looked around, and everybody around us was just crying. And I was with my parents, too, and my wife's in-laws, and even my father was crying. So, you know, it's one of those, you know, very emotional moments, and I look to my wife, and she's laughing, and she's just doing the best she can not to create a scene, but she can't control herself. And I look to her, and she whispers in my ear, "Yo, Adrian," just where that came from, who knows? You know,
it's a line from the Rocky movies.
Yeah, like I think it was Rocky III, where he's training in Russia, and Adrian comes to greet him as he's been training in these snow covered lands. And for some reason, she said she imagined Rocky out there drowning with everybody else in the Titanic. Just absurd, just completely absurd. But I think there's something deeper you can read into that, too, because the director, James Cameron, was essentially treating that climax the same way he treated Terminator 2 and Aliens and all these other movies, just with as much as he can fit in, as much of everything as he can fit in. In that case, it was just a sentimental kind of emotion rather than gunfights. And so my wife rebelled, like so often we do at funerals or whatever the situation is, or Evita, you know, when we just feel like we just can't handle it anymore, we have to laugh.
So that's an example. I think your wife is a great example there of the complexity of the brain, all these wild connections, and that the creative thinker can make connections that, you know, with a kind of flexibility in an interesting way that other people don't necessarily. You know, I thought that was so intriguing that she had that thought.
Yeah, I mean, who connects Titanic and Rocky? I mean, no one. They're so different, and that's
really
why. That's essentially what humor is, though, right? It's you're connecting ideas or things that you don't ordinarily connect.
So you say humor should be considered a process. It's not an outlook or a behavior.
I do, and that's why I don't think we'll ever simplify it to a formula, nor should we try. I think it's more of a psychological process, coping process, but it's good looking at it that way. You're not missing anything by recognizing that there's a lot of different things that can make us laugh. In fact, you're understanding better how we really operate. Our brains aren't simple, and when you understand humor, you'll understand consciousness, intelligence, creativity, all these broader things that really define us as humans.
So this way, you have a few New Yorker cartoons in here that are just terrific, and I was looking at one of them and then thinking about what you said, that laughing at something like a cartoon is really touching off the dopamine reward circuit, and that sends the dopamine throughout the brain. So what in the world is that different from listening to, you know, looking at cartoons different from listening to somebody doing stand-up or watching a television show?
Yeah, this is interesting. They're not that different, actually. I mean, the processes are very similar. And in fact, it's much broader even than that. That you mentioned dopamine, which is essentially our brain's reward chemical. Most people have heard of dopamine before because it really is linked with so much when we talk about the brain and cognition in general. And so basically our brain increases the amount of dopamine when we are doing something pleasurable. Dopamine is also responsible for the enjoyment of chocolate. Chocolate actually increases dopamine in our brain, and so does cocaine. Cocaine basically increases the amount of dopamine in our brain, which is why it's so addictive. So, I mean, that kind of makes humor a light high. But you see increases in dopamine during all kinds of jokes. The dopamine response area in the brain is active for cartoons, for visual, even auditory, like linguistic jokes. It doesn't matter. And there's studies that have shown that you get the same response in our dopamine centers during feeling down your spine, the chill down your spine when you listen to very emotional music, kind of like that epiphany feeling moment. You get response in your dopamine centers there, too. So it's really just a feeling of discovery that our brains enjoy, and we get the reward through dopamine.
What do you think nature, you know, there are people who attribute everything we do to something in nature. Oh, we were equipped this way because. So people have been laughing, and I would think having a sense of humor forever. What in the world? Why are we equipped with this? Is it a coping skill?
I think that it is. It's always tricky going back in time and guessing, you know, why did this evolve? Why do we have it? Because, you know, we'll never really know why we have humor. But you can come up with some pretty believable and logical stories that, I mean, back in the day before there was civilization, it was very difficult to resolve conflicts with people. You know, apes, when they get in a fight, they hit each other with sticks or something like that. But, you know, when you develop societies, you need to have a way to deal with anxiety and these conflicts in a more positive way. And so I think that's why humor and laughter, I should say in particular, between humans and apes is so similar. I mean, for apes, when they meet each other for the first time, they bare their teeth and they make grunting noises, which is very much like laughter. And we know that apes laugh. We know that dogs laugh. Even rats laugh. So I think we've just basically co-opted this behavior for a very important social purpose.
Scott Weems has a PhD in cognitive neuroscience. His book, Ha, looks at the science of when we laugh and why, the holy grail for comedians, and it is a great read. I come to a part in the book where you say, the best jokes are always lean, no fat, no extra words. That seems true to me, except with certain comedians. And then I think about your remarks that, you know, there's tension in us about this complex situation. There's surprise. It doesn't seem so simple. So, you know, and there are comedians. I think of Louis C.K. I think of it's not simple what they do. You know, it goes on and on and on. It's quite quite amazing. So how does that work? The best jokes are lean, no fat, no extra words. And yet we see comedians who can bring people to their knees with the opposite.
Yeah. Well, it's fascinating that, I mean, comedians, no two comedians are the same. I mean, you've got Robin Williams and Stephen Wright, two people who are as polar opposite as you can be, and yet they still have the same profession. Stephen Wright is the very slow talker who throws out jokes. You know, it might take a minute for him to get through a whole one, but you love him for it because you still laugh. But I would argue that there's one thing they have in common is that every word they use has a purpose. That doesn't mean that they have to speak fast or that they you know, jokes might not be short. But a lot of times the point isn't the punchline. A lot of the point is the build-up itself. And studies have shown that most laughter for jokes or any sort of humor doesn't come at the end. It actually comes all scattered throughout. So Louis C.K. is a great example. His humor is pretty much all based on stories with his personal life about his ex-wife or his two daughters. But he's telling a story, and he's bringing us through. And every little word that he's using isn't accidental. It's building that relationship with the audience and playing with expectations. And I'm thinking like the Saturday Night Live bit that he had this past weekend where he's talking about sitting through his children's recitals and how much he loved his daughters, but how painful it is to sit through an hour or two of a play that is just bad. And, you know, every bit of that's funny, even though there's no punchline at the end. It's the buildup that's really the funny part.
Mm-hmm. So in coming back to this idea that humor has to do with surprise, I thought, well, if that's true, and it seems to make sense to me, how is it that I keep watching Seinfeld reruns and laugh? I know I've seen these all so many times. I know what's coming. Sometimes I could quote them, and yet they are still so amusing to me. So if the brain is about surprise in terms of humor, why is that happening to me and other people? Why do reruns make so much money for the actors?
Oh, yeah, and there's some comedies like Seinfeld that I think we'll be laughing at for a very long time. They were just so good that, you know, you don't need to be shocked like you were the first time you saw it. And I think part of the answer to that is surprise is important, but it's also not the only ingredient. If surprise were it, then you're right. We would watch the comedy once, and that would be it. But there's some movies that I still – it's a guilty pleasure, but I've watched Harold and Kumar go to White Castle more times than I would like to share with your audience. And I still laugh, and that's about as juvenile as you get. You know, fourth, fifth, tenth viewing, I still laugh. Yeah. And I think part of it is humor needs to be about surprise, but there's a destination too. And here, it's probably best to talk about that with an example. So there is it would probably be like a Jay Leno stand-up bit where there's a newspaper headline and it says, "Lawyer testifies in horse suit." That's kind of funny, kind of ambiguous. Probably you don't laugh out loud when you hear it, but it might bring out a chuckle.
Yeah.
And the reason is because it's not just surprising, but there's a destination too. That destination being imagining a lawyer either, you know, being very proper or being held in contempt of court because he's wearing a horse mask and a furry outfit. So that one's funny, but, you know, at least a little bit. But what's not funny is lawyer testifies in suit, which is equally ambiguous. There's just no destination because it's not taking you someplace funny, i.e. not, you know, imagining a lawyer in a funny suit. So I'd say that we probably like Seinfeld and these other comedies because we like where they take us. They take us some funny places, and we'll probably enjoy that for a long time because these are fun destinations.
The psychologist Nancy Horn has been on our show. She's in New Haven, and she has often on our show, and she says that she thinks horror movies are our way of testing ourselves against the situation that we're confronted with in the movie, and that's part of why we can endure all the stuff that's going on. So, and I know you have a theory about this too. So, I wonder if it's not the same with, you know, shows like Seinfeld, that you're on some level testing yourself in this situation, and so you can watch it again and again. You know, plus it's good.
Yeah. You know, horror movies, I'm so glad you brought that up because there's been some fascinating studies on that. I'm not a fan of horror movies. I'll watch them, but they're not my favorite. My wife loves them. She loves roller coasters and stuff like that, too. And it's always bothered me. Why? Because you generally, in life, don't try to be afraid. And so a psychologist, Eduardo Andrade, I think is how you pronounce his name, he actually tested this. So he had people who were both fans and not fans of horror movies. Basically, followed their emotional states as they watched these films and found that people who watch these horror movies and like them, they're feeling both joy and fear together when they watch them. So it's not a simple emotional response. So I think it's a mistake to classify humor or horror movies or any of these experiences we seek out as a cleansing of emotion. That's kind of what Freud called catharsis. And I don't think catharsis is the answer. I think it's the opposite of that most people haven't heard of, which is called cathexis, which Freud also talked about, which is not the cleansing of emotions, but the full activation and enjoyment of emotions, the complex emotional experiences that really describe the high points of our life. So you're not washing away anything. You're actually fully activating not just one emotion, but many at once. And we like that. That's fun. That's part of being alive.
Scott Weems, author of Ha, The Science of When We Laugh and Why. I was intrigued when you went back in history to learn that humor has been pretty unpopular. Plato outlawed humor in the Republic, claiming that it distracted people from more serious matters. He was right about that. Ancient Greeks, enlightened people, they believed that laughter was dangerous because it leads to a loss of self-control. That's premature, too. Let me see. Thomas Hobbes was practical. He said humor is a necessary part of life, but only for people of inferior intellect.
Yeah.
And then, as you point out, the Bible is actually pretty aggressive about humor. And didn't somebody try and count how many times God laughs
in the Bible? They did in the Old Testament, and the number's 29.
29. Okay. So, well, that's interesting that they had God laughing. But usually, What kind of way would you say God is laughing in almost every scene?
So these researchers, they went through the Old Testament and counted the number of instances of laughter and then attributed each one to whatever emotional state. Was it a joyous laughter? Was it a contemptuous laughter? That kind of thing. And basically, only two, I think, were joy. So the rest were the kind of laughter that you don't necessarily want to hear from your God. These are the second psalm, laughing with contempt at the kings of the earth for thinking that they rule the world. This is not a good kind of laughter. And so it probably is an oversimplification to say that religion or these other ancient philosophers were aggressive towards humor, because you could find even Nietzsche, who was so negative in so many things, he had the occasional positive thing to say about humor. But in the most part, from the Bible to old philosophers, it was at best held with some hesitation and doubt as something that trivial minds do. And I don't think that's gone away.
So the thing is that humor is powerful and threatening, and through time. You know, this is the way to be radical. This is the way to be revolutionary, to move things like nothing else can. You know, we see this in political conflicts, people coming forward in countries all around the world and using humor to get at people, and it's effective.
It is. It's fascinating. And, I mean, there's a couple things about that. First, we like to think, well, we've kind of gone past that. We now can use humor to work through our differences. But when was the last time a comedy won an Oscar for Best Picture? It doesn't happen. I mean, the last one you could maybe say was a comedy was, I think, Annie Hall in 73. Recently, the president, President Obama, went on Zach Galifianakis' humorous online bit Between Two Ferns, which I absolutely love that show. It's not as well known. It's a shame. Between Two Ferns, it's just hilarious. And he had quite a number of people criticizing him for participating in such a frivolous, silly thing to do. But it had great effect. The number of people that went directly from that video to the Affordable Health Care Act website was huge. So it was a very useful thing that he did, but still people criticized him because it's not something the president should do.
So Scott, stay where you are. We're going to get into this. I want to talk with you about computers, whether they're getting funnier. We'll be right back with Scott Weems, author of Ha. I'm Faith Middleton. Thank you so much for listening. And thanks also to our talented team, senior producer Lori Mack and producer Jonathan McNichol. Wanted to let you know that it is the hottest scene in Connecticut, my Food Schmooze Martini Competition. Statewide bartenders shake up innovative martinis, and you vote. You vote. You get to vote. You have a ballot for the Food Schmooze Martini Champion. Designated driver discounts, great Top Chef noshes, our DJ sizzles. It sells out every time. Thursday, June 19th, 6 p.m., Simsbury's Riverview. We're giving you time to get a whole crowd together. People rent limos. I want to say thanks to Power Station Events for lighting and sound. Put on your dancing shoes. We'll tell you as time goes on about all the chefs and bartenders participating. $65 tickets benefit WNPR and CPTV. Order now at ctmartini.org. Scott Weems is with us. He has a PhD in cognitive neuroscience. In his book, Ha, looks at the science of when we laugh and why. He's making a distinction between laughter and humor. Scott, this explain to me how exploratory creativity connects with humor.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating that we often think of creativity as a single thing. It's just, you know, coming up with new ideas. But there's different grades of creativity, and I wound up having to kind of immerse myself in this when I was trying to understand, will computers ever be able to tell good jokes? And it's tricky, because I'll just throw one out as an example. What kind of murderer has moral fiber?
Oh, yeah, I know this one. Go ahead.
A serial killer. It's not laugh-out-loud funny. I mean, it's kind of clever, but it was made by a computer. That was a computer that just basically came up with an interesting analogy, played around with the words, and did that. And so
I'm impressed.
Yeah, I mean, it's not bad. In fact, it, you know, people have judged, rated it, and found it's about in the middle of, you know, funniness as far as, you know, the funniest joke in the world.
But, Scott, it's a machine.
I know. What do you expect? I mean...
Well, no. I think it's doing really well.
I know.
I mean, it's amazing to me. I thought that was pretty good for a machine.
Yeah. So it's not bad. I mean, it's pretty funny. But it's still not the highest level of creativity you can get. I mean, there's combining ideas in new ways, which is kind of what we do with most jokes, you know, or something like that. Nobody had really thought about moral fiber and serial killers before. So, you know, it's creative. But then there's the kind of, and here's where we can get to, like Lenny Bruce as a comedian. Nobody had tried doing comedy like him before when he took the stage. He's original. There haven't been too many people like him. And so you look at, like, what is truly creative? It's more than just putting together ideas in ways that haven't been done before. It's really just inventing a whole new genre. And there's some people who've looked at, like, this in music. When, for a long time, classical music always had a key tone, a key that the music always returned to, even though it might have, you know, wandered here and there. But eventually, music developed into a new kind of art form called atonality, which no longer had a home key. And this was shocking for some people. They didn't know how to take this. But eventually, it became quite popular and accepted. And so you can see that level of discomfort with all kinds of arts, including humor. And I think Lenny Bruce and a few others are pioneers in that way.
Well, I'm interested in what you say. You looked at 72 recent experiments about creativity and said no single brain region is consistently active during creative behavior. So we would think, you know, it would zero in on one mostly. But you say there's something special about people who make these novel connections or can imagine the unimaginable. And what sets them apart is a kind of connectivity within their resting brains.
Mm-hmm.
And so how does – do you mean that all these different parts, you described them before as this sort of chaotic, messy scene in there, connect rapid fire in unusual ways, and that's where we get the most creative kind of thinking?
Yeah, I mean, that's essentially it. There was a meta study that looked at every study that had examined the brain and looking for creative behavior, and found that there was no magic area, which was disappointing at first, but I don't think it's disappointing at all. I think it's actually very cool that what happens is that the most creative brain is one in which really the whole brain is active in coming up with solutions and problem solving.
So if you've got a highly connected brain, didn't they do this in Japan? So if you share brain activity over these multiple regions, this is going to tell us who the flexible and adaptive thinkers are.
Yeah. Yeah, and as you said, that you can look at this connectivity even when somebody's just resting. You can put an EEG on their head and measure how brain waves are connected with different parts. And you don't even need to be doing anything. These are just people who, even when they're resting, their whole brain is kind of communicating at a certain neural level. And that's a good thing. That's a whole brain approach to life.
I was kind of impressed with the computer that came up with that serial killer joke. On the other hand, you make a good point when you say, if we said to a computer, you know, what goes on at the mall, it's not going to come up with Stephen Wright's joke. Stephen Wright said there was a power outage at a department store yesterday and 20 people were trapped on the escalator.
Yeah. Yeah, and so this is what computers struggle with. They can't recognize what's a good joke. And because that takes world knowledge. You need to understand
context, huh?
Context and how all these things fit in the real world. And here you could actually look at this in a very mathematical way even and like what's the best finish to this sentence? He's so modest he pulled down the shade to change his blank. Now, a sort of funny response to that is he pulls down the shade to change his mind. It's mm-hmm. not laugh out loud funny, but it's kind of clever.
Clever.
And that's because you don't expect mind. You expect to change your clothes. That's most of the time when you talk, you know, when you're talking like that, you're talking about changing your clothes. But changing your mind is a little bit stranger. And this is getting why that's funny, even though there's even less common, you know, there's even more surprising endings to that sentence. But they're not funny because only a person knows that there's no difference between changing your mind in front of a window or not. That takes understanding how the world operates. And this is why mm-hmm. computers will have to be really on the intelligence level of humans to be able to get jokes.
So we have this computer, a link, at our website right now, WNPR.org. Search programs for the Faith Middleton Show, and you will find it. So this is a computer, and you can you explain how this works.
Oh, yeah. So basically, it's easy. It's
Scotland.
Out of University of Aberdeen, if I have the right
yep, site. Yeah, that's right.
And all you do is it asks you a few questions, you know, what rhymes with bunny or something like that. And then takes a few other just general question and answer kind of things. Then it only takes a second. And then it'll just generate its own joke. I don't have my book in front of me, so I don't remember what it came up for me when I first logged in. But it was, what do you call a witty rabbit?
Right.
A funny bunny.
Funny bunny. Yeah, not bad.
No, it's not bad. And, hey, it's coming up with this on its own. Nobody told it that was funny. And so that's pretty good. Now, having the computer know which ones it produces are funny and which ones it produces are stinkers, that's tough.
Huh. So you do a little test with the reader in your book about haikus, with these short-line poems, very famous in Japan, but now, as you point out, has spread around the world. And you try to get us to determine which little haiku was written by a computer and which one written by the 17th century Japanese poet Matsuo Basho, who's one of the great artists of all time in terms of haiku. And so here comes one, and as I'm saying this, as you're listening, think about this. Early dew, the water contains teaspoons of honey. That's a haiku. Here's another one. Now, which one of these two, written by computer and written by a person? Autumn moonlight, a worm digs silently into the chestnut. So, what do you think? Early dew, the water contains teaspoons of honey? Is that the computer, or is that a human being? Autumn moonlight, a worm digs silently into the chestnut. So, tell us, early dew, the water contains teaspoons of honey.
I'm gonna laugh and give you something really funny. I wrote the book and I forgot.
You don't remember? Hey, you know what? It's a year since this. You know, you handed in your manuscript. Why should you remember every line?
Yeah, I think that's amazing. That unless I got it in front.
Okay,
I forgot which one it is.
So, I'm a fan of haiku, so I did guess this, but it's autumn moonlight is the one written by Basho, and the early dew one. Teaspoons of honey and all that stuff. That's written by a machine. Okay, now here's one. Human or machine? I'll give you one more.
Okay.
Holy cow, a carton of milk seeking a church. And so I burst out laughing and I said, oh, it's got to be a machine. But no, it's not. right?
No, that was the machine.
It was? Was
that
it?
Was the machine. No, but here's where it got interesting, because they had the experimenters which did this. They gave all these haikus. And I love this because, yeah, I mean, some of these are impressive, at least for me. I mean, I don't know the difference. But so one subject, he just argued with the experimenters. And he said, no, that has to be a person, because no computer can come up with something that stupid. That's just too stupid for a computer to come up with. And I absolutely love that reasoning, because he's essentially getting at this highest level of creativity that we're talking about. He's saying, no, that is so out there that no computer could come up with that. That's too crazy. That's like who's the man on the moon comedian that was so out there that
Kaufman?
Yeah, I need something. Like, no, that's just so out there. It's not even comedy, people said about that. Well, that's kind of what that haiku is. It's so shocking that you just think, well, there's no way a computer could have done that.
Well, as you point out in the book, I'm glad you mentioned him, Andy Kaufman. I know you're such a fan of his, and mm-hmm. I have been too. And, you know, remember what he did? He took his whole audience out to get milk and cookies?
Yeah.
Didn't he? I mean,
he read Dickens to his audience once, and then when they booed him, he put on a phonograph, and it was him reading Dickens. Just, yeah.
Oh, I think about people like Jonathan Winters, who has this off the wall, eccentric, wild kind of humor and thinking in that Kaufman style. And I think, where does that come from? What is that about?
Yeah, and I think that's the kind of creativity that it's really uniquely human still, that you got to ask, where does that come from? And man, that's hard to answer, isn't it? And that's the most satisfying comedy, at least to me. I don't know, some people like Kaufman, some people don't. Some people don't like Lenny Bruce, and I can respect that too. But you have to give them this, that nobody had done anything like that before. Jerry Seinfeld, hilarious. I love his stand-up too. But, you know, he wasn't a groundbreaker in a lot of ways. He just did what he did very well.
Yeah.
And some people do things that nobody had even thought would be considered comedy, and you got to respect them for that.
Do you think that Jerry Seinfeld and Larry David broke ground in terms of minutia in comedy? Do you think?
They did. I think so. I mean, I actually like Larry David's show more than Seinfeld.
It's good.
Yeah, and it is. It's so awkward. And then you look at some TV like The Office, especially the first couple seasons, kind of pioneers in the awkwardness. And what Seinfeld did, just pointing out the daily weirdness of life. I mean, that hadn't been done before, so that was new. It's really tricky to say when something becomes so radical that you wouldn't have considered it even to be humor.
And you know what, Scott? I just realized that in this conversation, I've fallen into a trap that I promised myself I wouldn't get into, and I did. And that is, every single comedian I have mentioned is a man, I think.
Oh, you're right.
This is what happens to women in comedy. You know, there are so many brilliant women in comedy, although not enough. So what's going on there?
Yeah, so I'll just throw out a name, Mindy Kaling. I absolutely love Mindy Kaling. So if she's listening and wants to give me a call or write a blurb for the book, I would love it. It's fascinating. Men do outnumber women in comedy by far. I think only 12% of women, 12% of professional comedians are women. And that's terrible. And so you got to ask, why is that? And it's interesting because women laugh more than men. There have been studies that have eavesdropped on people and found that two women talking will laugh twice as much as two men. And so it could be, and there have been some philosophers that have come up with a theory, that women are raised to be the audience when it comes to humor, and men are raised to be the performers. I don't think you could say this rests like at the level of the brain, because studies have actually looked at male and female brains processing humor, and if anything, female brains are more active, not less.
And it can't be about quality, because there are the most genius women out there doing comedy. What an interesting book you have done. I just found it fascinating. Scott Weems, Weems. His book is called Ha, and it is The Science of When We Laugh and Why, and it makes a distinction between humor and laughter. But the facts, the studies, the way it all works, really interesting. Thanks so much, Scott.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, it's online at WNPR.org. As always, this show is about the richness of life. You can find the books, people, recipes, wines, cocktails that we feature right now at WNPR.org. Click on Programs. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.